You know what's great about the Volkswagen Sign and Drive event? No matter how you sign your name, you can get a great deal on select 2018 Volkswagen models. Sign perfectly neat, you get a great deal. Sign super messy, get a great deal. Sign outside the lines. Do one of those fancy weird signatures where your nine-letter last name looks like a half a V. You still get a great deal on models like the all-new Tiguan SUV or fun-to-drive Jetta. So practice your signature. Then head over to your nearest Volkswagen dealer for the Sign Then Drive event, going on now for a limited time.
Hit the road with Vons, Albertsons, Pavilions, Chevron, and Texaco. Now through June 27th, earn 4x gas reward points on items like Kraft Cheese, Oreos, Cheerios, Lay's Chips, Tide, and more. Look for tags and enter your phone number at checkout to earn points. Redeem rewards up to 20 cents off per gallon at participating Chevron or Texaco stations, and $1 off per gallon at Vons stations, up to 25 gallons on a single fill-up. Fuel your trip. Hashtag because summer fun. Other restrictions and exclusions apply. See store for details.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me.
Hello, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Now, we as humans shouldn't be quite so smug when we're, say, looking down at our steak. I do think we're more intelligent than steak and even the cow that it came from in most cases. But the truth is we are actually highly intelligent creatures who often act really, really stupidly. One of my favorite books on this subject is Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. And it's by social psychologists Dr. Carol Tavris and Dr. Elliot Aronson. And I'm thrilled tonight to have Dr. Tavris on my show to talk about their book, which I have recommended to countless readers of my column who are unhappy because they're being tripped up by common human irrationalities that we're all prone to. Dr. Tavris will talk about what these are, why we're so prone to them, and how we might avoid acting like such idiots. Hello, Carol.
Hello, Amy. What a wonderful introduction. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I love your book. It's one of my favorites because it's not only great on science, it's well written, which makes it a joy to read on two levels.
Thank you so much.
Now, there's a great quote right at the beginning that I put in my column a while back. I'm going to read it. Most people, when directly confronted by evidence that they are wrong, do not change their point of view or course of action, but justify it even more tenaciously. And you add that even irrefutable evidence is rarely enough to pierce the mental armor of self-justification.
You like that one, do you? That does about sum it up. And, you know, we've seen this recently with, of course, the doomsday predictions. What could be more clear evidence than that the fact that the world didn't, in fact, end on the day that people predict it will end? And do they say, whoa, I guess I was really wrong about that? No, it was they read the numbers wrong or the date's been changed and so forth. But the basic belief in doomsday continues. It's a natural mechanism of the human mind. We all do it. It's really easy to look at someone else and say, how could they be such a dork to continue believing something with this incredible clear evidence, you know, right in their lap? But the fact is we're all inclined to do it. And as you know from the book, the mechanism is this thing called cognitive dissonance. This term is everywhere now. It's on, you know, TV shows and papers. Everybody uses the term, sometimes even accurately. And all it means is, do you want me to say?
Let's find out the accurate meaning of the term, because I think people often use it inaccurately. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. It's very simple when you get it. And when you get it, you see it in yourself as well as you see it in other people. All it means is that you're holding two ideas that conflict with each other, that crash into each other, that don't live comfortably with each other. So the classic example is, of course, the smoker who knows that smoking is harmful. So the smoker is in a state of dissonance. I'm a smart, good, kind person, and I'm doing here this stupid thing, smoking. So the smoker, to reduce the discomfort of that awareness, has to do one of two things: quit smoking or justify smoking. I'll keep smoking, it'll make me, I'll die sooner, but I'll be thin. Or, you know, it reduces stress, and that's a bad thing to have stress, so it's good for me. So that's what dissonance is. It's this really uncomfortable feeling. And what my dear co-author, Elliot Aronson, did with this theory is he made it a theory of self-justification. What he showed is dissonance is most uncomfortable. We are most motivated to reduce it when something about ourselves, our feeling about ourselves as being good, kind, worthy, smart, ethical people, when we get evidence that we've just done something bad, evil, foolish, stupid, or hurtful. Now the dissonance is really painful because my choice is admit that I did something foolish, unethical, cruel, incompetent, and so forth, or maintain my view of myself as someone who doesn't make these mistakes and dismiss the evidence. Most people, and in terms of that quote that you like so much, most people choose self-justification rather than saying, yeah, that evidence shows I really did make a mess of this.
So tell us what self-justification is and how it works.
How it works is just this way. I do something. Let's say I have a choice between cheating and not cheating. This is actually from a real experiment. We talk about this in the book, and it's kind of the classic metaphor. You've got two students, and they're suddenly, you know, they don't think cheating is terrible, but they don't think cheating is the best thing to do. They have kind of mild attitudes about cheating, you know, like most of us. Should you cheat on this or not? Is it okay? Now, faced with the actual temptation to cheat, let's say one decides to cheat for the sake of getting a better grade, and the other decides not to cheat because they feel that is really an unethical thing to do. Now, the minute each of them makes a decision, they will justify the decision they made in order to preserve their belief in themselves as being good, ethical, and smart. So the one who cheated will now say, you know what, cheating is no big deal. Everybody cheats. It's just this one time anyway, and it's not important. I really need this grade because I have to get into pharmacy school. We all want pharmacists who've cheated on the grade. Okay, never mind. The other person who didn't cheat will also justify that decision to remain in harmony with their view of themselves, and they will come to think that cheating, in fact, is really a pretty serious offense. It's not a victimless crime. We all suffer when somebody cheats. And you know what? The cheaters should be expelled. In fact, we should hang them up by their ankles. So you start with these two people who have pretty much the same attitude about cheating. It's not so bad. It's not so good. But depending on their own behavior, when they're given the chance to cheat, they will justify whether they cheat or don't cheat. And over time, they will end up having moved very far apart from each other. The one who cheated will really minimize the seriousness of cheating, and the one who didn't cheat will think cheating is really serious. This is how it works for us in a thousand ways in our lives when we're faced with a decision. Do I want to believe that the vaccines cause autism? Do I want to believe that my cousin Mildred started this argument and I had nothing, this family fight, and I had nothing to do with it? Every time we make one of these choices or beliefs, we justify it because, after all, we think of ourselves as pretty smart, competent people. But what happens then is it becomes harder and harder for us to change our minds to accept evidence that we were wrong. Vaccines have nothing to do with autism. And, hey, by the way, maybe I had something to do with that family rift that's been going on for 39 years. You know. So the danger of self-justification is it's what lets us sleep at night in the aftermath of a particular choice that we made. But sometimes we may want to have a few sleepless nights if that's what's needed to get us to admit we were wrong.
Right. And I think the essential thing to think to emphasize here is that we are very compelled to protect our views of ourselves. And one of the things I love about your book, and I'm talking with Dr. Carol Tavris about mistakes were made, but not by me, why we justify foolish beliefs, bad decisions, and hurtful acts. One of the great things about this is it made me realize that this is what we do. And so I think, I mean, or maybe I'm just self-justifying that I do this less. And you know, I thought, well, you two must be, you know, really good at not doing this. And there's this great little bit in your book about your co-author, Dr. Elliot Aronson, how he bought a canoe in the middle of winter.
Oh, the canoe story is great. I mean, Elliot is the world's leading scientist in the field of cognitive dissonance. He knows this stuff. You know, every time I, you know, would make a decision or find myself in a state of dissonance, I would call him up and say, Elliot, help! What do I do now? But yes, he does indeed know how it works. And before I tell you the canoe story, what I want to say about this that I think is so important, there are a lot of things we learn about how our minds work and our biases and our irrationality and so forth. And many people start feeling depressed about this. You know, well, there's nothing I can do about it. This is how my brain works. But the thing about dissonance that is so fabulous is that when you understand how it works, it's like, when we learn to drive a car, you know that you've got a blind spot when you're backing up. And we all learn to compensate for that blind spot, because otherwise we'll be whomping into things. And it's the same with our mental blind spots. This is one we can learn to recognize and prepare for. It's wonderfully helpful. So in that respect, here's Elliot's canoe story. He had just taken a new job at the University of Minnesota, and he and his wife were deciding which house they wanted to buy. He wanted one that was near campus so he could play the cool young professor and have students come over and, you know, they could hang out together and he'd be right walking distance from school. But it was not in a great area for their kids. There wasn't really an outdoor area where the kids could play, and it was inconvenient for them. So his wife wanted to live out in the country in a lovely house near a lake. And he really didn't, because it was so far from campus. So there was much to-ing and fro-ing, and finally they decided the smart thing was the house in the country near the lake. And so they buy the house, and it's the middle of winter, and Elliot sees an ad for a canoe. So he goes and buys the canoe and comes home with his canoe lashed to the top of his car. This is December, when the ice is as thick in a Minnesota lake, you know, as an elephant. And his wife burst out laughing, and he said, what's so funny? And she said, you, the world's expert on cognitive dissonance? He was reducing the dissonance he felt about having bought the house that was his less favorite by emphasizing the benefits of the decision they'd made to buy that house. Come summer, we'll be able to use the canoe. And it was really funny. I mean, here's the guy who, the world's expert on cognitive dissonance, not noticing what he himself was doing to make that decision a more positive one for him. We do this all the time, by the way, with decisions. Before we make a decision, what car to buy, what job to take, what school to go to, before we make a decision, we have open minds. We accept the evidence for each choice, pro and con. We talk to a lot of people. We get the evidence that this car is better than that car, and so on. After we make the decision, we have post-decision dissonance. Now we want to justify the choice we made. So what happens is people stop looking at ads for the car they didn't buy. They only look at ads for the car they did buy and all the benefits of the car they did buy. All the good things about the decision we made, and all the bad things about the decision we didn't make. Okay, so this is why it's a beneficial thing to be able to reduce dissonance. You don't want to, you know, sit there night after night worrying about, you know, this decision that you made. But once again, it's important to understand how it works so that if it turns out we really did make the wrong decision, we haven't so justified it. We haven't put in so much mental energy justifying it and blocking out what might be the benefits of other courses of action that we can change our minds. And this is important in every aspect of life, in the work we do, in the beliefs we hold, in the way we run our businesses, the way we are in our families. It's important to be able to say, I did this believing it was the right thing, but now I see there's evidence suggesting maybe there's a better way.
Now, you said people find this depressing, but actually, you know, I look at this cognitive dissonance as hilarious. And and what helps me, I think, is Albert Ellis's advice, and he's a swear word in here, that we are all fallible, messed up creatures, you know, and that if you see humans like that, including yourself, then you don't need to maintain this self-image that's perfect, and it's a little easier to look for the places where you screwed up.
Absolutely it is. See, people, you know, this is very interesting that you say this, Amy, because people feel that it's difficult to admit that they were wrong or to change their minds. But in fact, you know, people put a lot of emotional energy into protecting their point of view. But as soon as they say to the other person, hey, honey, you know that fight we've been having for the last 32 years? I've thought about it a lot, and I've decided you're right and I'm wrong. How do you suppose people will react when you say something like that? They're going to be delighted, of course. And then they're going to say, and you know what, you are actually kind of right, too, about that thing we have been arguing about. You know, it's people do put a lot of emotional energy into protecting a point of view when, in fact, it's often a relief to stop trying to protect it and to move forward to a better, more useful belief or attitude.
In fact, you have this great chapter on letting go and owning up, and I just wrote a chapter on the apology, and you have this great quote. It's just is such a relief to just own up, and you say, the mind wants to protect itself from the pain of dissonance with a balm of self-justification, but the soul wants to confess.
Thank you, Amy. Boy, you've really read this book closely.
I absolutely have. And actually, speaking of which, I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight's brain belongs to social psychologist Dr. Carol Tavris, co-author with Dr. Elliot Aronson of Mistakes Were Made by Not By Me, about how we justify foolish beliefs, why we justify foolish beliefs, bad decisions, and hurtful acts, when they usually ultimately come back to bite us. So just getting back to that, the owning up, how do we feel when people admit making mistakes? Isn't this just the greatest gift you could give another person?
Well, it certainly is, if indeed you're able to do that. But you see, the reason it's difficult, see, look, if someone says to me, here's the evidence that you are truly a terrible cook, I am not going to feel any dissonance about this because I'm not a good cook. It's not something I've ever really done. It doesn't affect my self-image. But here's the thing. This is the crucial point. The more time, effort, commitment we have put into something, into a belief or a practice or a way of doing something, whether it's in our professional lives or our personal lives, the more we have invested in something, the harder it becomes to say, I was wrong, because over the many years of doing something a certain way, and perhaps having caused harm, if you were a therapist or a teacher or a doctor who was holding on to some practice that was in fact out of date because you didn't change your mind, you didn't change your practice, the harder it becomes to admit we were wrong. I mean, if you look at the history of medicine and the doctors who perpetrated, it's something as simple as not washing their hands and causing the deaths of women in the delivering room, as happened in, as you know, the opening story in the book. These are not evil doctors. They're not evil people. It's because they see themselves as good people, good doctors, compassionate doctors, that they find it hard, if not difficult, to accept the evidence that what they've been doing, failing to wash their hands, is killing their patients. Because that realization means they have to go back and think about patients that they might have harmed.
I witnessed a shocking, shocking presentation at USC by Gary Taubes, who is the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat. He's going to come on the show pretty soon.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Oh, he's amazing. And basically, he showed, it's like a giant meta-analysis, which is a study about studies, 600 pages, good calories, bad calories, showing that basically carbs, so sugar, flour, starchy vegetables like potatoes, apple juice, cause the insulin secretion that puts on fat. So the point was, he basically was talking to all these childhood obesity researchers. He presented this like an hour, a mountain of evidence. And afterward, I looked around. I talked to some people and asked them if they were going to change their practices. Basically, they were doing the opposite that he said, making these children swell up like Augustus Gloop and Charlie in the Chocolate Factory through their practices, and they were just going to go back and do what they were doing, despite being shown pretty much incontrovertible evidence that what they were doing was tormenting, torturing children, and making them fat.
Well,
so horrible.
You know, when you have him on your show, you tell him I'm one of his big fans, and I use his book as an example of the cognitive dissonance that reading his book creates in people who have both either professionally or personally believed that that carbohydrates are good for you. You know, the cover of his book is butter on whole wheat bread. And I said, I used to think that was a stupid cover. And then you look at it and you think, well, it's the bread that's good and the butter that's bad. And by the time you finish the book, you realize it's the butter that's good and the bread that's bad.
Right.
It's a fantastic example of how cognitive dissonance works. Most of us in our country have invested enormous energy and belief in notions of what kind of food is better or worse for us. Our country has believed that fat is what makes us fat. So we have all these low-fat foods, which have done nothing to reduce the problem of obesity. So this is why, this is a very good example of why it is so important to understand how cognitive dissonance works. The people in Tobbs's audience aren't idiots, and they're not mean, and they're not fools, but they are people who have a vested lifelong interest in believing that fat is the hazard and carbohydrates is not. And for them to accept the evidence that they were wrong, think what that means. Think what they have to be able to say. Now, the goal of science, I love that you say your show, nerd science, but the goal of science is to make us face dissonance, if you will. It makes us put our beliefs to the test and to be willing to accept the evidence that we were wrong. This is not a natural habit for the human mind. It's not easy, but we can certainly learn to do it better than we do.
And that's why I want to emphasize again, to realize that to be a screw-up is the human condition, to be fallible, this is such an important thing because it allows you some leeway, some emotional, psychological leeway when you've made a mistake, to wonder if you've made a mistake. And you write about this also in your book, great stuff about how when there's a culture of, okay, mistakes happen, we don't love them, that it goes better. There's this great quote, I love this. You have so many great quotes in your book. This is about this guy, young guy, he made a $10 million mistake at IBM, and of course he thought he'd be fired. Most corporations probably would fire him. And so the guy came up to the legendary IBM founder, Tom Watson, and he said, I guess you want my resignation. And Watson said, you can't be serious. We've just spent $10 million educating you.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And what that quote shows, of course, is that having a culture that accepts human fallibility starts at the top. Employees are not fools to want to hide evidence of mistakes that they know that they've made, of course, because they know that they could get sacked if they admit them. But companies can go a long way toward making it possible for people to change, to do new things, to come up with new ideas, to be willing to let go of old ideas just because they're old. You know, maybe there's a new, better way of doing things. And to make it possible for people to let go of old habits and old ways of doing things, and the mistakes, by the way, that go along with that.
I find it very helpful, actually, to have a workplace where there's a culture where criticism is welcomed. And this describes my own workplace. I have a woman who edits me part-time, and then I have a copy editor at my syndicate. And basically, this woman who edits me, her job is to tell me, I'm an idiot. I got the science wrong. It's not funny. It doesn't make sense. You know, and when that's your, you have it going on every week, you get a little easier and it, about criticism. And it's not that I'm going to take criticism from just anyone, because I have to respect somebody's mind and their literary judgment. But I'm open to people I consider wise to tell me I'm being an ass.
Well, it's a tremendously important thing, Amy. I mean, I hear from so many educators across the country at all levels of education who tell me that children and up to college students and graduate students can't accept criticism because they feel you're criticizing them, not what they've done, not the work they've done, but them. Students who will burst into tears if you edit their prose or tell them that they don't know how to write a sentence. They feel that, you know, you're somehow attacking them at the core. What all students need to understand is that I'm me, I'm okay, I'm a good person, and here's this work I just did, which could perhaps use some improvement. And it's essential to separate that, because otherwise there's no learning, there's no progress.
Yeah, and you have a study in here that looked at kids, you know, which kids did better, the kids who were told, I think it was, well, you'll know this, the kids who were told that they were wonderful people, what's the other?
Smart.
Right.
Some children were praised for being naturally smart, and some kids were praised for working hard, you know, in how they do. The reason that this matters, I mean, most parents think, boy, you want to say, you know, you really want to praise a kid for a quality that's somehow in them. But what happens is what children need to learn is that the goal of learning is to master the skill, not to learn it in order to perform it and show off for others, but to learn it for its own sake, for its intrinsic benefits. And so children who learn for the sake of showing off or performing tend to give up when they make a mistake or if they fail. They're too embarrassed by the failure. But kids who are learning to master the skill for its own sake understand that you can't master it unless you make a lot of mistakes along the way. And so, you see, it's a matter of understanding. When I said earlier that the worst kind of dissonance, the most painful kind of dissonance, is if our own self-concept is attacked. I see myself as good and competent, and now you're telling me I'm bad and incompetent. That's the hardest thing for us to accept. But if we can separate these things, when I make a mistake, I remain a good and competent person, and this mistake is still a mistake which I need to fix.
Oh,
you've
got to
separate those. And that's your favorite quote, isn't
that's
it?
My favorite. I talked to Carol before the show. I love this quote. This is in 1985, Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres was thrown into dissonance by Ronald Reagan's visit to the Bitburg Cemetery, where 49 SS officers were buried. And we were friends with Israel, and they didn't think this was so nice. So when asked about Reagan's actions, Peres neither condemned Reagan nor minimized what he did, and he said, when a friend makes a mistake, the friend remains a friend and the mistake remains a mistake. I just think that's so great.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And you see what Shimon Peres was doing was helping everybody learn how best to reduce dissonance. Here's what dissonance is. Dissonance is what you feel when your best friend does something foolish, cruel, or wrong, right? Now you have to do what happens to, in most cases, is people say, well, that's no friend of mine anymore, or that little criminal act, you know, that little murder he committed, I guess it really wasn't so important after all, he can still be my friend. You can see this in the news all the time when people are thrown into dissonance when their favorite political candidate or their favorite celebrity or their favorite anybody does something illegal, immoral, or fattening, right? You either stop supporting that person or you minimize what the person did. What Shimon Peres was telling us was there is a third way. In the third way, you both keep the friend and acknowledge the seriousness of the mistake. The friend remains a friend and the mistake remains a mistake. That is the third way that we can learn to live with dissonance, a way that preserves friendships but doesn't minimize harms or wrong ideas. So, and likewise, we can say this of ourselves. When I make a mistake, I remain okay, but the mistake remains a mistake. I don't want to deny it, ignore it, suppress it, or justify it.
And now I just want to add to this that, you know, one thing that's important for me to remember is that humans are complicated. You're not going to agree with everything some person thinks.
You're not?
Well, it depends.
Okay. I'm sorry, Amy.
Intellectual twin. But, you know, the thing is to, if you basically like somebody, just ignore that they, for example, for me, a big problem is when people believe in astrology because, I mean, come on. I mean, it's just, or other irrational things. I just think, well, they have all these good qualities. We just aren't going to talk about astrology or talk about what they think about politics because it's not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to convince them of anything. They're not going to convince me of anything. So why don't we just talk about shoes? You know,
yeah.
It's just, it's a much more productive thing.
What Elliot Aronson would say in that light is, what we want to do is accept the package that is a person. Every person comes with qualities that we like about them and some things that we wish we could change if we only, you know, could do this. Sometimes we marry the person and set about trying to change them. But in fact, most of the time we're not going to be able to. And so what you are saying is exactly the right thing. To avoid being in a constant state of cognitive dissonance with a friend who differs from us in some attitude, you accept that that's who they are, that's what they think, that's what they do, and you don't have arguments, constant arguments about it. Of course, if the difference between you is a make or break issue for the friendship, then that's another matter. But for the most part, for most people in most of our friendships, there's going to be something like that.
Absolutely. And I want to get to more of your wonderful book, Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, and I'm discussing this with Dr. Carol Tavros, who is the co-author with Dr. Elliot Aronson. And Greg says he has a question, but he says he'll do it live in 10 minutes. Okay. In that case, I just wanted to get into something you mentioned before. And this relates, for example, to these crazy frat initiations. Frats have these insane initiations, and your co-author, Dr. Elliot Aronson, predicted that if people go through a lot of pain, discomfort, or embarrassment to get something, that they'll be happier than if it came easily.
Yes, this is one of his most famous experiments, and it was done at a time when people believed, you know, that we do things, you know, for the joy of getting into a group, and we aren't going to do things that are painful or harmful to us and so forth. And he did the cutest, the simplest, but the most wonderful experiment. He had young women, college women, go through either a mild or a severe initiation to get into a group that was going to be discussing sex. And in the mild initiation, they didn't have really much to do, but in the severe initiation, it involved their reading some rather racy words, which at the time was a really excruciating, embarrassing experience for these young women. What he found was, and the group, by the way, the group which they then got into, turns out to be the most extraordinarily boring, dull, and uninteresting group of people you could ever possibly imagine. It was all scripted, what they were going to say. And to the sex, it was the sex life of, you know, the blue-faced booby or something, some bird from, you know, South America. Not exactly the kind of sex discussion they were expecting. Just tedious. So the question is, what would these women think about this objectively tedious, awful, and boring group? The women who went through the severe, embarrassing initiation decided they really liked the group. That discussion was really interesting. Boy, I really never knew that about those birds. The women who went through the mild initiation saw the group exactly for what it was, boring and worthless. So this study, which came to be called Severity of Initiation on Liking for the Group, became the best example of how dissonance works, because basically these women are saying, you know, I just went through hell and high water to get into this group that turns out to be stupid and useless. What am I going to do to reduce that dissonance? Well, you can't deny the fact that you've just gone through hell and high water to get into it, so you decide the group is really cool after all. And, of course, we see now this is the same mechanism that accounts for the success of fraternities hazing, for military severity of treatment of, you know, first-year, you know, rookies and cadets and so forth, because at the end of that awful year of initiation, the new member says, boy, this group must really be worth belonging to.
Now, this relates to sunk cost fallacy, which I've written about in my column, which is a term from economics, and it talks about the fallacy where people, they look at what they've invested in something to decide whether to continue rather than looking at what they'll get out. And, of course, the rational thing is to look at how is this going to pay off and not, you know, continue with some, you know, person who's a terrible partner just because you've spent 2 years with them. But we are prone to do this.
Exactly right. And dissonance is the mechanism that causes us to overlook the sunk costs. These are two concepts that really, really are explanatory. You know, they go hand in glove in an explanatory way. That's exactly right. The more time, effort, and money we invest in something, the more motivated we are to justify it. Because the alternative is to say, what an idiot I've been. I've spent all that time and money on this stupid program. One of my favorite studies that we talk about in the book is the people who went through some self-help program, which was totally useless, and they resolved dissonance by misremembering how bad off they were at the beginning. It really helped me. It really helped me because I was so bad before I began this program. So we find ways. We find ways.
I just love that. And actually, speaking of the biases of memory, you tell this great story. Well, first of all, actually, I should have you go back because I want, for people that came on late, I want you just to explain again what is dissonance and what is self-justification.
Okay. Cognitive dissonance is the experience of having two ideas in your mind at the same time that are fighting with each other, that are in conflict, that do not live harmoniously. I am a good person, but I have just done something really bad. I am a kind person, but I have just done something really hurtful to another person. I am a competent person, and I have just screwed up at work. Those feelings of dissonance are really uncomfortable, and we are motivated to reduce them. We can reduce them by changing our view of ourselves or by justifying that thing that we did. It didn't really hurt the other person, and besides, it was their fault.
And so self-justification we use to protect our views of ourselves is a wonderful, smart, highly intelligent, fantastic human beings, which we have a hard time believing if we admit to making a mistake.
The bigger the mistake, the greater the harm, the more likely it is that we will justify what we did. To me, one of the most important messages of our book is that the problems we have are not just caused, we think, you know, our problems are caused by bad people who do bad things. What Elliot and I would say is no, they're caused by good people who justify the bad things they do to preserve their belief that they're good people.
Wow.
That's the killer. It's good people who continue to do bad things because they justify them and don't see them for the harm they do.
Wow, that's really powerful. Now, I want to get into memory because you're just talking about memory. And along the lines of what you were just saying, you know, you say in your book, and I should do a little station ID, mistakes were made, but not by me, by Dr. Carol Tavris and Dr. Elliot Aronson. It's one of my favorite books. It's very well written and really smart, so I think people should buy it. So just getting back to memory, when two people have different memories of the same event, you say that observers assume one is lying, but you say most of the time we're self-justifying. And you have this great quote, memory becomes our personal live-in self-justifying historian. And you, along with Elliot, have this great story about yourself, about the biases of memory, and you tell a story about a book that your father read you, or did he?
Oh, that story. Oh, yes. People think of memory as a literal thing there in the brain. You know, it's a tape recorder. It keeps a little accurate, you know, count of everything that's happening to us. But it's not. Memory is fallible and flexible, and we rewrite our memories to conform to our current beliefs. So if your relationship with your mother now is good, you'll tend to remember the good things in your childhood and forget the bad ones. And if your relationship is bad, you won't remember so many of the good things your mother did for you. That's the nature of memory. It keeps our current beliefs consonant with our what we choose to remember. The story that I told in the book, it was such a shocker, is that I remember my father reading James Thurber's wonderful book, The Wonderful O, which is, by the way, a book I recommend to everybody. It's the most terrific little book. And I remember my father reading it to me. It's a wonderful book to read aloud. It's got lots of internal rhymes. It's witty. It's charming. It's funny. It's sharp. I love that book, and I just see my father reading this to me. And so one day I got the book out to look at it again, and I saw that the publication year was 1 year after my father had died when I was 11 years old. Mm. And it rattled my brain in the way that happens when we have a memory. We're so sure of something. We're so sure it happened this way. And then you're just hit in the head with evidence that it didn't happen that way at all. And so that's a benign example, of course. Often it happens, you know, more often where we have a memory of some event and someone tells us it didn't happen that way at all. And it's a very rocky, almost scary feeling because someone's telling you your memory is wrong. It's why people get into so many arguments about whose memory is right, you know, because it's just it's so powerful. So in my case, I don't know to this day who read me that story, but it was it fit perfectly with my memories of my father. It was the kind of thing he would have done. what I was trying to convey is how shocking it is to people to discover that a memory is wrong.
I felt so much better about this because I thought that I had invented the line, that looks like a penis, only smaller, and I was convinced that I said this to a guy in New York who exposed himself to me, and that did happen, but I probably didn't say anything witty. I probably just sort of ran away, you know, and I read that line somewhere, and I constructed that, and I'm not a liar. You know, now someone said, that's not your line, and I looked it up, and it was like in 5,000 pages, 5 million pages on the internet, and I realized, oh, my God, what a jerk. And your book helped explain that to me in a way that made me feel like somebody whose mind just put this together rather than I'm a liar.
Well, you know, that's very good. And that, you see, you've just said something really very important. It's self-compassion and self-forgiveness. We all do bloopery things with greater or less magnitude. And after we understand where that mistake came from and how it happened, of course, in the case of a serious mistake, not what you've just told me, but in a serious thing, you want to learn from it. You want to learn from it so that you won't do it again. But really learn from it so that you won't do it again, where you were going off the rails or what the belief was. But then, after that, then you have to put down the burden and say, I can forgive myself now. I mean, as long as I don't do this again, as long as I'm not just suppressing this, I've really learned something here. So in a very small way, you've understood about self-forgiveness. Oh, this is how memory works. Isn't that an interesting thing to know? Perfectly natural that I would get this great line. The first time I heard that line, I suppose I was 8 years old. It was a classic Jewish joke, you know, in New York. It was actually a joke that Freudians used to tell as an example of a castrating female joke.
Yeah,
but the point is only you came to understand how memory works, that you would just incorporate something into your memory, make it fit, and then learn later that maybe it didn't happen that way.
And your book really gave me an out because it made me not feel so bad about it. I thought, well, I remember saying that. And it's the same way you remembered this book being read to you by your father that was published, you know, a year after he died. And so I think that is one very helpful thing of the many helpful things in your book, Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. And I'm talking with Dr. Carol Tavris about her wonderful book with Dr. Elliot Aronson, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. And boy, do we. And just getting to what you're saying about self-forgiveness, to realize, look, I'm fallible. This is being human. It's not me. We're all fallible. You know, in relationships, you say that successful partners extend to each other the same self-forgiving ways that we extend to ourselves. So if you can do this yourself and realize, oh, we're fallible, you know, then you can be a little bit easier about your partner being fallible. You don't think, oh, my God, they're a horrible person and they hate me and they're trying to screw me over. You think that they're human and they got tired or they got lazy. And we all do, you know, so it's just a little easier to let things go that way if you look with that view.
Well, yes, exactly. See, what Elliot Aronson would say about this, every couple, when you first get together and, you know, you fall in love and there you are together and everybody's in a state of major happiness until dissonance raises its head and you discover that the beloved suddenly has a flaw. A flaw? Oh, my God, the beloved has a flaw. Okay, now you're in a state of dissonance. My beautiful, perfect beloved has a flaw. Okay, so now you have a choice. What happy couples do, what successful couples do, is they attribute the flaw to something that isn't terribly important, or is, you know, the person's behavior is not a sign that they're a thoughtless lout, but they're under a lot of stress at work, and they've had a bad day, and besides, they're just a human being. Unhappy couples attribute the flaw to something in that person's character. I knew it! He's a snake in the grass! How dare he do this to me, okay? And so you can see that the two different ways of thinking about the partner's behavior will lead, in one case, straight down the pike to divorce and the other to a continued satisfying relationship. The behavior of the other person remains flawed, something you don't like, but it's how you see it, how you reduce the dissonance that determines whether that relationship's going to make it or not. And in one direction, you have a forgiving, tolerant, accepting way of reducing the dissonance, and the other, it just gets spirals into increasing anger and blame.
Now, one way that I think it makes it easier to accept the flaws is if you know what they are. And one thing that I recommend, and that, you know, that I did in my own relationship, when you start to get serious about someone, look at what all their flaws are. Literally catalog their flaws, because nobody breaks up with somebody because they're hilarious or great in bed. They break up because of all the stuff that you don't want to look at or think about. Oh, they leave their clothes all over the place. They don't pay their bills on time. See if you can live with the flaws. You know, and then when they do these things, this is normal. You know, it's like a dog, you know, raises its leg and poops on and pees on a fence. You know, and if you got mad at your dog for that, that would be weird and unreasonable, because that's what dogs do. And the same thing with accepting somebody's flaws. Then, you know, hopefully they're not going to, you know, pee on a fence. But
sweetheart leaves his socks on the floor, he remains my sweetheart, and the socks remain on the floor. Is that what
you're saying? I love that.
There you go. So, yeah. No, well, you're absolutely right. What you're saying is, you want to be aware of the sources of dissonance before you get committed. You want to know what those things are, and so that you go into a relationship with open eyes, so that you don't then, the second you're living together, say, okay, now I'm going to fix you, without maybe fixing yourself as well.
Right. You make me remind me that I don't cook, I heat, and that's not really going to get fixed. So you bring up this great chicken and egg question. Which comes first, a couple's unhappiness with each other or their negative ways of thinking about each other? And you say it works in both directions, you know, but which comes first?
Which comes first is the negative explanation. I mean, just as I said, and just as you said, in every relationship, I mean, nobody's habits will mesh completely perfectly. So the other person will eventually behave in some way that you don't like. At that point, you have a choice of how you want to explain and deal with this conflict, this difference between you. You have a choice. Many people don't see it that way. It's all the other person's fault. Well, it's how the person is. So now your task is to figure out, is this a make-or-break problem, or is this something I can live with, and how best can I live with it? You know, one of the really interesting things about writing a book is the stories and reactions that you get from people about what the book has meant to them or how they've used it. And I was giving a talk not long ago, and a man in the audience got up and he said, I want to tell you about something I learned from your book. He said, my family has been having, the siblings have all been having a terrible argument for years and years. Now, we've been fighting over the inheritance and the, you know, the estate. Okay, a typical family quarrel. He said, this has been going on for 7 years. He said, a few years ago, you know, when your book first came out, I gave it to our mediator, and I said, give them this book so they can see what they're doing wrong. I mean, he sort of implied that that was the thing. See, if they read this, they'll see how they're justifying and how wrong they are. Okay,
that's
so we all laughed. And he said, I want you to know that a couple of months ago, I read your book again, and this time I called the mediator and I said, I'm ready to tell them what our side has been doing wrong.
Wow.
He said, magically, the words changed on the page of your book, and I suddenly saw it a different way. I said, what is my part in this rift? My part in this rift? He said, we got this resolved in 2 days.
Wow. Oh,
isn't
my God.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Flipped my heart upside down because he got it. He got the point, which is that to the extent that we're always willing to say it's the other guy, the other guy. What's my part in my own life story? My father treated me this way, and I'm mad at him for it. Was I the kind of kid who might have caused him to treat me that way? We tend to write ourselves our part out of these memories.
Wow. God, that's so powerful. And I want to say to people, as an advice columnist, if someone helps you, an author, an advice columnist, a tow truck driver, appreciate them, tell them. And actually, you just heard what a difference it makes to hear that what you've been doing has made a difference in someone else's life.
Absolutely.
And now Greg actually has a question. So, Greg, I'm hoping you're live. Are you there?
Yes. I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I think you'll be able to figure it out. But it's Ndamukong Suh is the 307-pound defensive tackle for the Detroit Lions. Where I'm from, Detroit, Amy is too. He wantonly stomped on a guy's arm on national TV. I just sent Amy the picture. There is zero doubt. You know, he was punished and cost the team the game, et cetera, fined, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then this month he's profiled in Gentleman's Quarterly, where he had ample opportunity with a really good writer to own up to what has become known as the stomping. Instead, he and his family circled the wagons and created a distortion field and basically called it an accident. So, I mean, this is where we're all sort of brought into this somehow.
Well, why in the world would you imagine that he would say, gee, I was really wrong to stomp on this guy? What incentive, what reason, why would he possibly want to say that? Okay, that's your question. Okay, there's a few things going on here. First of all, what the story illustrates is how deeply, how profoundly we justify the mistakes we made. The greater the mistake, the greater the harm, the greater the crime, the greater the cruelty, the more justified we are to excuse ourselves. It was an accident. I didn't intend the thing. It was part of the game. That's just what happens. It's no big deal. We minimize it. If we can't say it didn't happen at all, we try to minimize it, or it was the other guy's fault, and so forth. That's the default way of trying to reduce dissonance. In our book, we ended each chapter with an example of somebody who broke out of that cocoon of self-justification. And in those stories, you see the pain of doing that, of how difficult it is to be honest with ourselves, the greater the offense we have committed. So, a therapist who was responsible for splitting up dozens of families with recovered memory therapy and who wakes up in the middle of the night sweating with the realization of what she's done because her basic belief was wrong, or a doctor who wakes up in the middle of the night, or a district attorney who realizes he put an innocent man in prison for 25 years because he wouldn't listen to evidence of the guy's innocence. How do these people live with themselves? So this guy, I don't know that particular story, but he has no incentive, internally or externally, to tell the truth. He doesn't want to get fined. He doesn't want to be penalized. His fans support him because they support him. And he wants to see himself as a good guy who did the right thing.
I actually want to quote one of these great quotes that you have at the end of a chapter of someone who took a different route. And I do agree with you. You know, he just didn't have incentive. People want to believe that he, you know, was a good guy. And I saw the picture from Greg. The guy is stomping very hard on this other player. It's horrible. But this author and activist, Vivian Gornick, I've actually blogged this quote from your book. She wrote at age 65, she's a feminist author, she's an activist. She blamed the fact that she was alone on the patriarchy, blah, 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 for years, but that she came to realize that, in her words, much of my loneliness was self-inflicted, having more to do with my angry, self-divided personality than with sexism. I just want to read the rest of the quote. The reality was, I was not alone because of my politics, but because I did not know how to live in a decent way with another human being. In the name of equality, I tormented every man who'd ever loved me until he left me. I called them on everything, never let anything go, held them up to accountability in ways that wearied us both. There was, of course, more than a grain of truth in everything I said, but those grains, no matter how numerous, need not have been the sand pile that crushed the life out of love. Oh, my God.
I know. It's tremendously powerful. It's tremendously powerful, and it shows the courage that it took for her to see, as I said earlier, her own part in her own life story. And as Elliot Aronson said when I came to him with this example, he said, and just imagine if she'd been able to do this so many years earlier. See,
right.
That is the reason for understanding how dissonance works and how we can learn to find other ways of reducing it than by excusing our mistakes, but by admitting them.
And that's why I think your book is so important. It's mistakes were made, but not by me. Why we justify foolish beliefs, bad decisions, and hurtful acts. It's by Dr. Carol Tavris and Dr. Elliot Aronson. And, you know, one of these things in the love chapter is actually talk about how a mediator said, never in the history of 4,000-plus custody mediations he's done has a parent ever said, you know, I think he or she should get custody because he or she is a better parent. You know, and everybody wants to believe they're doing the best for their kids, but they're not.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Well, exactly right. That's what mediators are up against, is exactly this thing. I'm the better parent. I know what's right. And, of course, you see, the more that you see it that way and that way only, the more you have to deny the other person's skills and abilities. You see, as long as it's in an adversarial situation where, both each parent has to prove that they're the best, they will have every incentive to blame the other person for being far worse than they in fact really are.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, at the end of your book, you say that by looking at our actions critically and dispassionately, as if we were observing somebody else, that this is the best way for us to stand a chance of breaking out of the cycle of action, you know, self-justification, you know, in the wake of cognitive dissonance. And so can you tell people a little bit about how they can do that?
Well, what it really means is that when you're confronted with evidence, let's say for a belief that you've had, let's say it's a food, like a diet thing, you know, or vaccines and autism, or an ongoing family quarrel and so forth. What we can all learn to do is to figure out how to examine new evidence for its strength and validity, recognizing that if we're starting to get an agitated feeling of I want to throw this information out the window right now, maybe we're feeling a little dissonance here and we should just relax, take a deep breath, and consider that maybe we're wrong. Because ultimately the larger question is, don't we want the best treatments for our children? Don't we want our doctors to do the best kind of medicine? Don't we want a diet that really makes the most sense? You know, okay, I've been eating carbs for 27 years. Maybe I should try something else now, you know. Don't we want a better way of doing things? And that's the best guiding thing. I mean, I think, you know, in the case of district attorneys who have kept an innocent person in prison for many, many years, they have too much invested in seeing themselves as the good guys in the white hats for the most part to be able to admit their own mistakes. That's why we need to have supervising committees in institutions like that and organizations like that. But for most of us, on an everyday level, we can learn to say, what's the evidence for this belief? Is there a better way of doing things? Could I have been wrong? Could I be better at what I do? And those realizations ultimately are so much more satisfying and gratifying than trying to prop up our self-esteem on little sticks of straw.
Wow. This has been such a wonderful show. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. And tonight's wonderful brain is that of Dr. Carol Tavra. She's the co-author with Dr. Elliot Aronson of Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. Carol, thank you so much. It's such an amazing show.
Thank you, Amy. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
It's just been great. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Hit the road with Vons, Albertsons, Pavilions, Chevron, and Texaco. Now through June 27th, earn 4x gas reward points on items like Kraft Cheese, Oreos, Cheerios, Lay's Chips, Tide, and more. Look for tags and enter your phone number at checkout to earn points. Redeem rewards up to 20 cents off per gallon at participating Chevron or Texaco stations, and $1 off per gallon at Vons stations, up to 25 gallons in a single fill-up. Fuel your trip. Hashtag because summer fun. Other restrictions and exclusions apply. See store for details. Hit the road with Vons, Albertsons, Pavilions, Chevron, and Texaco. Now through June 27th, earn 4x gas reward points on items like Kraft Cheese, Oreos, Cheerios, Lay's Chips, Tide, and more. Look for tags and enter your phone number at checkout to earn points. Redeem rewards up to 20 cents off per gallon at participating Chevron or Texaco stations, and $1 off per gallon at Vons stations, up to 25 gallons in a single fill-up. Fuel your trip. Hashtag because summer fun. Other restrictions and exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hi, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda person, and recently we've been doing random acts of helpfulness, like buying gifts for families and bringing a daughter in the Navy home for the holidays. And during the Happy Honda Day sales event, we can help you too with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the Accord, a 2017 Car and Driver 10 Best, a record 31 times. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you, and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know. Car and Driver, January 2017.